This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, February 10th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On September 20th, 2001, 9 days after the attacks of September 11th, President George W. Bush, in an address to a joint session of Congress, declared a war on terror, which he said begins with Al-Qaeda but does not end there.
They want to overthrow existing governments in many Muslim countries, such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. They want to drive Israel out of the Middle East. They want to drive Christians and Jews out of vast regions of Asia and Africa. These terrorists kill not merely to end lives, but to disrupt and end a way of life. With every atrocity, they hope that America grows fearful, retreating from the world and forsaking our friends. They stand against us because we stand in their way.
16 years later, Donald Trump is sounding the same theme. Here's what he said on Monday at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa.
Radical Islamic terrorists are determined to strike our homeland as they did on 9/11, as they did from Boston to Orlando to San Bernardino and all across Europe. It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it. They have their reasons, and you understand that. So today we deliver a message in one very unified voice to these forces of death and destruction. America and its allies will defeat you. We will defeat them.
The New Yorker's Ryan Lizza joins me from Washington to discuss the political uses of fear as a guiding principle of leadership. Hey, Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It occurred to me this morning that you are now covering your third president for The New Yorker. So I wanted to start by asking you to briefly explain how we got from the Bush doctrine to Trump's executive order on immigration.
So much of the Obama administration was, and really the end of the Bush administration, there was basically a bipartisan consensus that Bush had gone too far with the anti-terror structure that was put into place after 9/11, right? And this is not exactly unique to that historical moment, right? You know, when there's a lot of fear in the country and the country feels threatened, those are the times in American history where we have curbed civil liberties and, you know, taken questionable constitutional steps to justify security. Like, you know, this has been well documented by the end of the Bush administration. Even Bush, you know, agreed with that and, you know, a lot of the reporting of that last 2 years was that people like Dick Cheney and the real hardliners were sidelined, and President Bush tried to bring things like warrantless surveillance, unlawful detention abroad in the CIA black sites. He tried to bring all of those things under more solid legal grounding. Obama accelerated all that, and you know, one of the core anti-terror policies of the Obama era was to roll back the excesses of the Bush years. And then all of a sudden, with Trump, who, let's be honest, doesn't have a well thought out view of these policies, especially the legalities, it's much more instinctual. And frankly, if you think about what he said about Muslims, simply bigoted.
Stoked, by the way, by his advisor, Bannon, who writes a lot of his talking points.
Absolutely. And if you want to give it a veneer of intellectual credibility, he has surrounded himself with a group of people who have just overthrown the Bush and Obama view that we'd have to do everything in our power not to turn a fight against terrorism into a religious war, right? And he surrounded himself with people who believe it is a religious war, that the root of Islam as a religion is the problem.
So the threats are different today. I understand that. But has the psychology of voters changed, too? The Trump-Bannon vision is not grounded in the philosophy of either party. In Trump's fear-mongering, he seems to be trying to create the terrifying environment he claims to abhor. Has any other former president pursued this particular tactic?
it's a great point, because the cliche in politics is the more optimistic candidate always wins. And
yes,
you had to appeal to America's sense of optimism. And if you look at his two most high-profile speeches, Donald Trump, the ones that where the most care and thought went into producing them, his convention speech and his inaugural address, they were, of course, the darkest addresses of his campaign. The White House's absolute obsession and mission to get the American public to focus on terrorism as an existential threat, I find mind-boggling. Since the awfulness of 9/11, we have had 10 terror attacks committed by 12 people, where 94 Americans have died. Now, 10 attacks is a lot. It's never a good thing when one person dies from terrorism. But, you know, Obama, by the end of his presidency, I think, had gotten the balance right, that said, we've done a great job, our homeland is more secure, and what we're doing abroad is trying to win the psychological battle so the people who are on the bubble of becoming radicalized don't get radicalized. And in the United States, reaching out to Islamic communities to make sure that we're not alienating people who are self-radicalizing, which, of course, is the real threat over the last few years. And then final point on that, those 12 people who committed those 10 attacks since 9/11 were all either American citizens or permanent residents, because, you know, it's very hard to get into the United States. So that's why, you know, most counterterrorism people you talk to look at what Trump did, and it's like, this is banning people from these seven countries, stopping the refugee program. It's not, there's no problem that this is actually solving.
In that piece this week, you cite some really stark assessments by former counterterrorism officials and others about what's going on here, what's behind this policy, insofar as it is a policy. You cite people like John Yoo, but he was not the only former Bush official who's alarmed by what Trump seems to be doing. Tell us a little bit about what they think is going on here.
I think the common thread in all of these accounts is, one, Trump's remedy here with the executive order is not actually addressing something that is a significant threat. And two, more of a political analysis, that it is frightening to most of these people in the piece that I talked to, that he is hyping, exaggerating, trying to get the media to focus on Islamic terrorism at a period, at least in the United States, where it's relatively calm. And, you know, the argument is, if you do that before, God forbid, there's an attack in the United States, what happens when there is an actual attack? I think there are two sets of policies that these legal experts point to as ones that Trump might reach for after an attack. One is the ones that we're familiar with, that were instituted by Bush after 9/11, but most of which have been curbed. CIA black sites, which the administration has already toyed with reopening those, what he calls enhanced interrogations, also known as torture, which obviously Trump has repeatedly said he is interested in bringing back. And, you know, maybe more scary is a domestic warrantless surveillance regime, and maybe some loosening of the FISA regime, which is the court you have to go through to do any domestic surveillance. So those were all the things from the Bush era that, you know, then you have to ask, what are the things that could go further? And that's when it gets even scarier.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a second. But first, just bring us up to date quickly on the battle between Trump and the judiciary, where it stands now.
So yesterday, the Ninth Circuit completely rejected the administration's argument about whether the stay that the judge in Seattle, whether that stay should stay in effect. They basically said that the administration didn't bring any legal arguments to the table that convinced them that they should lift the stay while this case makes its way through the legal system. You know, one of the things that this is where we get into scary arguments and what happens after a terrorist attack. One of the arguments that the Trump administration made to the court was that the court did not have reviewability. In other words, the Trump administration said the president's powers over national security and immigration policy are so vast that the judicial branch of the government is not even allowed to review them. That is an argument that they laughed at. This is a paraphrase, but the court basically said that argument lacks a basic understanding of the constitutional structure. But that gives you a hint of what they might argue later on. So that was one big thing they looked at. But the second was that they were not convinced that the government had made a national security case for why they should lift the stay on the executive order. And I think where things stand now, people on the right believe that this is such an overwhelming rebuke of Trump that they are arguing that Trump should abandon the case and rewrite the executive order, because if this case goes any further, it's going to set into place restrictions on Trump's powers and any future president's powers that are far worse than anyone imagined. A couple of commentators are saying that if you read the opinion closely, that the court wants to say that non-Americans may have a right to judicial review if they get rejected for a visa, if they want to come to the United States. In a scenario where this executive order is deemed unconstitutional, it might affect a future president's ability to have expansive authorities in the area of immigration.
And then, speaking of conservatives, we have Trump's very own Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, expressing dismay over Trump's attack on judges.
One of the reasons conservatives liked Gorsuch is he's not super deferential to the executive branch. And so, it's anyone's guess where he would come. If he were on the court, if he got confirmed quickly enough, and this case did come before the Supreme Court, it's, a bit of a guessing game where he would come down. Now that we have Jeff Sessions, the very conservative senator from Alabama, in place as the attorney general, and now that Trump will have a fuller legal team in place at the Justice Department, I think what happens now is they will review this very carefully and decide whether they've sort of made a terrible mistake here and that this is not the war they actually want to fight.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
How do you see the relationship shaping up between Trump and the other key branch of government? We see that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are more or less, so far, lining up behind Trump.
I totally agree with that. Privately, most of these Republicans have the same obvious concerns about Trump that everyone does. There's a very obvious deal that was struck. They wanted a good Supreme Court justice. They want a good tax bill and less regulation. And if Trump will sign those things, then all of the other things that concern them about Trump will be worth it.
Do you see John McCain and Lindsey Graham as outliers here for their very outspoken critiques of the administration on a number of fronts?
I think on foreign policy, they're not quite out. There are divisions up on the Hill on foreign policy. There are people who are closer to Trump, who's less interventionist, and people who are closer to McCain, who's obviously more interventionist. But I don't think McCain and Graham are outliers.
Well, except on the Putin-Russia front, just insofar as they're willing to go out on a limb and attack the administration on issues they disagree with.
That's the difference. That is the main difference. Is there are those who will say all this to you privately and will articulate all of the fears and concerns privately about Trump, and the ones that'll do it publicly. There's not as much difference between Republicans on what they think about Trump. It's just a matter of politics and whether they think it's in their best interest to go after him. I mean, one thing, if you're just reviewing the week, I don't want to exaggerate this, but I do feel like this was a week. And look, what is this, the third week? It feels like the third year, but it's only the third week. I do feel like this is a week where some of the normal institutional restraints started to kick in a little bit on a White House that is a very, very aggressive. Another small example is Kellyanne Conway yesterday, who violated a federal regulation by endorsing Ivanka Trump's clothing line from the White House in a TV interview. I thought, okay, well, this will be another thing that no Republican will care about. Actually, Congressman Chaffetz, who runs the Government Oversight Committee in the House, joined with his Democratic colleague, sent a letter to the Office of Government Ethics and said disciplinary action should be taken. So there's a minor example of Congress stepping in and doing a little bit of oversight, which we haven't seen in the previous 3 weeks. And then I do feel like the media, which has really struggled to cover Trump, has become much more aggressive and just plain spoken about this administration when it lies, when it's deceitful, in a way that they, I don't think, were as comfortable doing during the campaign.
But it does sound as though you somewhat disagree at this point with those who are speculating, really, that the Trump administration could pose a greater threat to our democracy than any of his perceived enemies.
No. I agree with that 100%. I agree. And look, you know, there's that famous Moshe Gessen essay in the New York Review of Books about, you know, living and covering in an autocracy. And now I know there's a lot of debate about that essay, whether she's exaggerated the threat from Trump or not. But I thought a lot of interesting insights. And, you know, one of the things that she says in there is don't be fooled by small signs of normalcy. So maybe I'm being a little bit fooled by a small sign of normalcy.
But we do have a constitution, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier on. Just review for us one more time what protections the Constitution offers to curb a president who appears to be intent on creating an autocracy.
Think of the oversight that Republicans did when they were in power in Congress against Obama. Think of the Benghazi investigations. So that's why I thought, you know, this small sign of one Republican joining with one Democrat and saying what Kellyanne Conway did was clearly out of line. You know, I take your point. That small sign of normalcy may not amount to much. But I don't think Donald Trump is he and his administration, when the court issued the stay on the executive order, the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, they abided by it. Now, that's a really low bar. Oh, the president listened to the court and didn't act recklessly and illegally. But, you know, that is a sign that our democracy is not completely on the verge of collapse.
We should probably end it right there before you take that back. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Ryan Lizza is the magazine's Washington correspondent. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with help from Daniel Wenger. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.